The title of his address this evening is Thomas Merton, the Catholic Church and the Racial Divide in the United States. So would you please join me in giving a very warm welcome to His Excellency Bishop Braxton.
Good evening to all of you, and thank you, Dr. Pearson, for your words of welcome. All of you should have a copy of the outline, which we will be following, though I think the version of the outline you have has been changed so that what you have as in number one is number C, the imperatives, they become number B, and number B becomes C, but that doesn't really matter. And the title I probably have changed since you received the notification, Thomas Merton and the Racial Divide in the United States, the Catholic Church, and the Black Lives Matter Movement is actually the way I have organized this lecture this evening. But let us begin with prayer. Let us begin with prayer for our world, for our church, for our nation, and in a special way for the community of the Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Park Lane, Florida. We will pray in the words of Thomas Merton. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. O Lord our God, we have no idea where we are going. We do not see the road ahead of us. We cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do we really know ourselves, and the fact that we think we are following your will does not mean that we are actually doing so. But we believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and we hope we have that desire in all that we are doing. We hope that we will never do anything apart from that desire. And we hope that if we do this, your will leads us by the right road, though we may know nothing about it. Therefore, we will trust you always. Though we may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, we will not fear, for you are ever with us. And you will never leave us to face our perils alone. You will never leave us to face our perils alone. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Thomas Merton and the Racial Divide in the United States, the Catholic Church, and the Black Lives Matter movement. This is not a simple topic. Everyone has an opinion about the racial divide in the United States. The city of Louisville has its own history of the racial divide in the United States. Your neighborhoods, your churches, your schools, perhaps your most famous citizen, Muhammad Ali, was outspoken in many occasions about the racial divide in the United States and here in Louisville. It is not a simple topic. The life of Thomas Merton is not a simple topic because his was not a simple life. It was a complex life lived on many planes, and many people have opinions, pro and con, about the life of Thomas Merton. The writings of Thomas Merton also provoke a variety of opinions that are not simple matters. The role of the Catholic Church in the United States and the part that the Catholic Church has played in creating and bridging the racial divide is not a simple one. It continues to be a complex one, and it is real as the headlines of this morning's newspaper. So it is not a simple topic. And therefore, as you follow my remarks, I hope you will heed these imperatives, which are drawn in some ways from my readings of the writings of the great Jesuit Bernard J.F. Lonergan, as well as from Thomas Merton, and finally, from simply being a guilty bystander myself. These imperatives are: listen, learn, think, pray, and act. Throughout my remarks, I will refer to these, but they are meant to be the goal marks for the way to respond to the racial divide in the United States. If you are going to contribute to building that bridge, you must listen, truly listen, to the signs of the time. Listen to yourself, listen to your neighbors, listen to the morning's news, listen to the teachings of the Catholic Church, listen to the gospel, listen to those with whom you disagree completely, listen to those who seem to be on the other side of the racial divide. Listen. Learn from that listening. Go over and over the things that you are learning. Think about what you are learning. And then listen again. Listen, learn, think, and at the heart, pray. Turn these things over in your heart in the presence of the divine, in the silent presence of holy mystery, of Hagia Sophia. Pray. But most of all, if you listen, learn, think, and pray, and do nothing, the racial divide shall never be bridged. You must act. You must heed the words of St. Teresa of Calcutta, who told me face to face when I was with her on the streets of Calcutta in India, everybody can do something. Everybody can do something. When people criticize Mother Teresa because of what she was not doing, she was not changing the social structures of India, she said, no, that is right. But my sisters and I, we are doing what we can. We are doing what we can. Everyone can do something. You know the existential situation in which you find yourself. Listen, learn, think, pray, act. Thomas Merton's influence on my life and ministry as priest and as bishop. If you travel to the southern part of France, you'll see in a house in Prades, France, an inscription in these words. The inscription says, "Ici est né Thomas Merton, écrivain américain." Écrivain américain, American writer. He goes on to say he was born on January 31st, 1915. 103 years ago. In typical French simplicity, only two words to describe him. Écrivain américain, an American writer. Not a Catholic priest, not a prophet in the face of war and peace, not an opponent to the virulent racial bias in the United States, not a spiritual master, not a Trappist monk. Écrivain américain. The first time I saw Father Thomas Merton, I was a seminarian studying for the priesthood in the Archdiocese of Chicago. I was on retreat at the Trappist Monastery of Our Lady of Gethsemane. Armed with my well-worn copy of the Seven Story Mountain, I was hoping to meet him. I did not. However, one of the monks pointed him out, and in a barely audible whisper said, "There, there is Father Lewis. There, there is Father Lewis." The second time I saw him was a year later when I was again on retreat. Father Lewis gave a conference for retreatants. This was the first and last time I ever heard his voice in person. For more than 40 years, I have continued to return to Gethsemane for retreat almost every year as a Catholic priest and as a bishop. As I came to know the monks, some of them painted inspiring and often very colorful portraits of their most famous fellow searcher for God alone. In time, I was befriended by Brother Patrick Hart, who, as the secretary to the abbot and a close confidant of Father Lewis, and assisted him in many things, seemed to breathe Thomas Merton. And from him, I gleaned an intimate portrait of the Trappist mystic, especially in our conversations on the porch of Father Lewis's hermitage in the Kentucky hills, far away from the monastic enclosure. My life and ministry as a priest and a bishop have been significantly influenced by a kind of spiritual conversation with Father Lewis. Reading every major work and devouring his letters, which, like those of Flannery O'Connor, are a revelation. Reading his works, finding myself now agreeing, then seriously disagreeing, then agreeing once more, then disagreeing once again, but always, always amazed, challenged, enlightened, enriched, enlivened, and enlarged. When Thomas Merton's remarkable spirit left this world 50 years ago on December 10th, 1998, the same day that the great Swiss Reformed theologian Karl Barth left this world, the same Karl Barth that Thomas Merton used to comment about, the fact that Barth played Beethoven, played Mozart every day, even though he was not a Catholic like Mozart. And Thomas Merton said, "Well, the fact that he played Mozart every day, it's probably the Mozart in him and the Mozart in me, not our writings, that will be our salvation." He died 50 years ago, December 10th, 1968, 9 months after the heinous murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, 1968. When his noble spirit left this world, I experienced the kind of sadness that one feels on the death of a friend. Many years later, I was present in the gallery on September 24th, 2015, when His Holiness Pope Francis became the first pontiff in history to address both chambers of the Congress of the United States with remarks that, to the surprise of his listeners, focused not on church doctrines or church disciplines, but on four influential Americans, Abraham Lincoln, Dorothy Day, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Trappist mystic, Father Thomas Merton. The fact that he did this surprised everyone, and none expected the pontiff to call attention to the ever-provocative Thomas Merton. Nevertheless, in his conjectures of a guilty bystander, this Cistercian monk wrote searing condemnations of racial bias and prejudice in the United States of America, especially in the virulent form it took in the 1960s. In his own way, Thomas Merton's writings are an unambiguous affirmation that black lives really do matter. And he wrote from his perspective, as he said, as one who was a Southerner and who was, in a certain sense, a guilty bystander in the face of the racial divide in the United States. The Roman pontiff, calling Father Merton a source of spiritual inspiration and a guide for many people, said he was above all a man of prayer. Above all. He was above all, said the Holy Father, a thinker who challenged the certitudes of his times and opened new horizons for souls and for the church. He was also, in the words of the Bishop of Rome, a promoter of peace between peoples, a promoter of peace between religions, and a man of dialogue. A man of dialogue. I believe that Thomas Merton was moved into the forefront of the dialogue about the racial divide in the United States as a guilty bystander, as he said, in the face of the ongoing racial traumas of the 1960s, the same traumas that I was viewing in my 20s and experiencing in my 20s, he was viewing them and experiencing them in his 40s. These include, all of these, of course, were factors leading to the development of his seminal magisterial Letters to a White Liberal. He was much influenced, of course, by the prophetic writings of James Baldwin, particularly The Fire Next Time, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s April 6, 1963 letter from a Birmingham jail, "The Negro is Your Brother." He was also influenced by the monumental August 28, 1963 Great March on Washington, D.C. for jobs and freedom. He was deeply distressed by the unspeakable evil of the murder of Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Carol Denise McNair in the September 15, 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham at the hands, the bloodstained hands, of the Ku Klux Klan. He noted the fierce debate over the passage of the Civil Rights Bill and the protest marches in Birmingham, Alabama, and of course, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s monumental letter from a Birmingham jail. He couldn't help but to notice the way Dr. King made use of the word "the Negro" with such noble dignity in employing the same expression, "the Negro," with noble dignity in his own letter to a white liberal. And he was deeply struck and distressed, of course, and shocked by the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy in Dallas, which he considered the Deep South, on November 23, 1963. All of these things and others troubled the soul of this man who considered himself a white Southerner, having lived so much of his life in Kentucky, and who considered himself a guilty bystander, an observer, so to speak, of the racial divide in the United States. In a certain sense, we are all guilty bystanders. We are all guilty bystanders. Section 2, the Black Lives Matter movement. A, origins. In different settings around the United States, I am frequently asked the same question. What do you think about the Black Lives Matter movement? What is the position of the Catholic Church concerning the Black Lives Matter movement? Why are Catholic leaders silent about such an important, albeit controversial, social development? Some voices, black and white, have condemned this movement as a violent ideology, urging attacks on police officers, encouraging the destruction and disruption of daily lives of innocent citizens by blocking traffic on major thoroughfares, closing down places of business, interrupting gatherings of political candidates, and perhaps unwittingly participating in black genocide by strong support for the so-called right of women to terminate their pregnancies. Other voices have compared the movement to the historic civil rights movement of the 1960s, the movement that so influenced Thomas Merton. Even though the current movement's loud, brash, in-your-face tactics may lack the discipline and the clear focus of that earlier movement, The Black Lives Matter movement has staged more than 1,800 protests around the country, die-ins in shopping malls and the like, which are intended to make everyone aware of the movement's grievances. In spite of the profound differences and seeming incompatibility between the teachings of the Catholic Church and the Black Lives Matter movement, there may be ways in which the church and the movement might benefit from some conversation, at least to become better informed about this movement, which Time magazine placed fourth on its list of the 8 candidates for the Person of the Year in December 2015, because of its growing influence. My modest goal this evening in these reflections is simply to share with you some themes that might foster your own knowledge and conversation about the Catholic Church, Thomas Merton, and the Black Lives Matter movement that otherwise might not take place. I cannot provide an overview of all the questions provided by this topic, but I can at least perhaps provide you with a frame of reference, a perspective within which you can listen, learn, think, pray, and act. Listen, learn, think, pray, and act. Only in this way can our position as guilty bystanders be transformed into active bridge builders. B. Jesus of Nazareth, all lives matter. All human beings, as conscious subjects, feel strongly that their individual lives matter. Our lives matter to us as individuals, our families, our friends, neighbors, co-workers, and others. Ideally, all of our lives should matter to every human being. But every morning's newspaper cries out in today's world that everyone's life does not matter. We have only to think of all the grieving families for the 17 who were so cruelly slain at the Marjory Stoneham Douglas High School in Park Lane, Florida, just days ago. Just one more in an endless litany of the barbaric slaying of young people in our country. Every morning's newspaper reminds us that all lives do not matter to all of us. Certainly from the perspective, the theological perspective of the authentic teachings of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, your life and my life should matter to everyone on the planet. In the gospel, Jesus of Nazareth, drawing from Deuteronomy and Leviticus, teaches us to love God with our whole being and to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. When he is asked who is our neighbor, Jesus tells us the story of the man who's beaten, robbed, ignored by members of his community who should have helped him. Yet a man who was considered an enemy had pity on him, bound his wounds, took him to an inn saying, "Take care of him. I will pay whatever it costs." And Jesus asks us, who was the true neighbor to the man who was violently attacked? We know what our response must be. It is the one who showed compassion. Jesus of Nazareth tells us, go and do likewise. He teaches us the law of love. Go and do likewise. The teaching of Scripture and Jesus himself make it clear that for a Christian, a Catholic, and for the Catholic Church, all lives should matter. Many Americans say this should be the end of the question. Obviously, if all lives matter, then Black lives matter. Yet this seemingly obvious truth has not been a sufficient answer to those whose voices are raised in protest in the Black Lives Matter movement. Why is this? Several supporters of the movement call our attention to George Orwell's parable Animal Farm for the answer. They remind us of the mantra of the totalitarian world in which the novel is set. And the mantra, of course, is all animals are equal. All animals are equal. But over time, the mantra changes. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. The tension between Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter perhaps can be clarified with an example. You're in your house on a cold, rainy night like tonight, with your family, plenty to eat, the fireplace is burning, music is playing, you're happy as husband, wife, mother, father, son, daughter. Someone bangs on the door. It's a poor, starving family, huddled, not enough clothing, no warmth against the cold. Can you help us, sir? Can you help us, ma'am? We need some food, we need some clothing. And you say, we are about to have dinner. Our family is busy. About a 5-mile walk down the road, I think there's some kind of a shelter that you can find. Sir, ma'am, we can't make it that far. Don't you think our lives matter? And you say, well, my life and my family's life matters too, and we're about to have dinner. Leave us alone. But perhaps just then, the ice cracks, the light dawns, eureka insight, and you realize at that moment, it is the lives of the freezing family at the door. It is their lives that are in peril. It is their lives that are in peril. It isn't that their lives matter more or less than your life and the lives of your family, but at that moment, their lives are in peril. And if you understand the gospel, you realize you must act. Listen, learn, think, pray, and act. At that moment, their lives are in peril. And some would say, in the experiment of the United States, it is at this moment, as it has been at so many moments, that the lives of people of color, that the lives of African Americans are in peril. It is not enough to say, make your way to the shelter 5 cold, rainy miles away. All lives really do matter. C, the catalyst. The catalyst. Many people know very little about Black Lives Matter. They do not know that the movement began initially as a hashtag, which became a protest slogan fueled by an internet-driven international protest confronting what its originators and others believed to be indifference to the death of young, unarmed African-American men at the hands of white law enforcement representatives. The phrase is more a call to action against racial profiling, police brutality, and racial injustice than a specific organization. The media and the public often associate a variety of unconnected groups with the Black Lives Matter movement, even when they actually are not structurally connected. The first appearance of Black Lives Matter occurred when a Facebook post by Ms. Alicia Garza, Ms. Patrice Cooler, and Ms. Opal Tometi used the expression after Mr. George Zimmerman was acquitted in the shooting death of Mr. Trayvon Martin, 17, an unarmed African-American man, on February 26 in Sanford, Florida. When this happened, these women and other activists created the Black Lives Matter hashtag, and the social media page followed. But later, after Mr. Michael Brown Jr., 19, another unarmed African-American youth, was fatally shot in Ferguson, Missouri, by Mr. Darren Wilson, a former police officer. When that happened, the movement became even stronger. And later, when Mr. Eric Garner died in what was called a police chokehold, the movement gained greater prominence. And so demonstrators and marches around the country and around the world shouted, "Hands up, don't shoot. Can't breathe. Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter." And this was a call to attention, calling everyone's attention to what was perceived by many people to be the systemic bias and racial prejudice in the criminal justice system and particularly in the behavior of some, not all, some representatives of law enforcement. The complaint is not that all young black men, all young African-American men are always innocent of wrongdoing. We know that this is not true. The complaint is that even someone who may have broken the law should not be tried, convicted, executed on the street. Even if he has broken the law, he has the right to be given formal trial, especially if perhaps the offense he has committed is a relatively modest one. And how does it happen that he dies before anyone has a chance to examine the allegations against him? I'm sure Louisville has its own examples, but a particularly egregious example occurred in my hometown of Chicago. On October 20th, 2014, Mr. Laquan McDonald, 17, who was armed with a knife, died after being shot 16 times by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. The shooting was videotaped on the police car dashboard camera. However, the video, which showed Mr. McDonald to be walking away from the officer, was not initially released to the public. The Black Lives Matter group protested and demanded by closing down streets in Chicago, protesting up and down Michigan Avenue, demanded that Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the Superintendent of Police, Gary McCarthy, act. It took months and months and months for the video to be released. But when it was, the man who shot Laquan McDonald was finally charged with murder. The result of all of this are yet to be known. In contrast to what happened to young Mr. Quan McDonald, consider another example. The barbaric slaughter of the innocents on June 17, 2015 in Mother Emanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston by 21-year-old Dylan Roof, a white supremacist, pictured wrapped in the Confederate flag, horrified many when he said he felt called to establish a race war. These wonderful people gathered in prayer, embraced him, and welcomed him. And as they stood for the benediction, he took out his gun and he slew them. However, when the police apprehended him, he was not beaten, he was not shot and killed, he was not harmed or injured in any way. Indeed, by some accounts, since he was hungry, he was offered hamburgers, french fries, and milkshakes from Burger King's. This is an example of the challenge that we face. How can it be that some are willing to ignore the terrible reality that actions of some police and the decisions of some criminal justice agencies, the activities in many prisons, and the effort to make it difficult for people of color to vote strongly suggest that for some in the United States, for some Americans, in certain circumstances, black lives really do not matter. Black lives really do not matter. This movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, which was very much led in its infancy and to the present by women, consciously embraces those who many people might be embarrassed by, those who are seen at the margins of the African-American community, such as those who are disabled, those who are undocumented, those who are homosexual, those who are lesbian, and those who are transgender. All of this makes for awkward conversation because these are realities about which many people, including many Catholics, would prefer to be silent, even if friends or family members may be associated in some way with these realities. As it happens, and significantly, Dr. Ben Carson, the distinguished pediatric neurosurgeon who was briefly by a strange fate and a stranger fortune, a leading Republican presidential candidate, and who is now the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development in the current administration, he has argued that many people involved with the Black Lives Matter movement, they're all misguided. He argues that it is not unjust treatment by white police officers that fill Americans' urban communities with people who daily face growing hopelessness. He says that law enforcement and the judicial system are not the reason why young African American men and women are unemployed, lacking the skills needed to compete in the modern job market. Dr. Carson believes that many African American families are suffering from self-inflicted wounds. As a pioneering specialist in health care of infants, he has expressed a particular concern about the number of African American lives that are extinguished in the womb by abortion. Dr. Carson has singled out the failed public school system as the source of African American suffering because they are not really teaching children how to learn or how to live. He makes a strong case for this. However, those who criticize Dr. Carson from the point of view of the Black Lives Matter movement say his ideas are determined by his age, by his education, by his social standing, by his wealth, by his conservative Republican ideology, and by his strict adherence to a certain understanding of the Seventh-day Adventist faith. The catalyst, the Black Lives Matter movement. When we hear this background, we must commit ourselves to listen, learn, think, pray, and act. To listen, to learn, to think, and to pray, and to act. Section 3, the Catholic Church and the Black Lives Matter movement. A, the reality. Some numbers for you. There are roughly 69 million Roman Catholics in the United States. Oh, don't worry, they won't be in church on Sunday. But there they are. Currently, only about 40% of Catholics in the United States are faithful churchgoers. The others appear at Easter and Christmas and for weddings, funerals, and baptisms. Of these 69 million Catholics, only about 2.9 million are African Americans. Out of 69 million, only 2.9 million are African Americans. For that reason, many Catholics of European backgrounds never ever see an African American Catholic. Of the 255 active bishops in the United States, there are 15 living African American bishops, of whom 7 are retired, 8 are active. Only 6 are ordinaries who actually govern dioceses. 2 are auxiliary bishops, including Bishop Joseph Perry, who has been the auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of Chicago for 20 years. Of the nearly 40,000 priests in the United States, there are barely 250 African American priests. There are 430 African American deacons, which is a blessing to the church. Of the 75 seminarians of African descent in the United States, many of these are Africans, not African Americans. They are Nigerians, Kenyans, Ugandans, and the like. Of the estimated 48,000 religious sisters in the United States, there are fewer than 300 African American sisters. And of course, we just lost a giant in Franciscan Sister of Mary, Sister Antonio Ibo, who died on November 11th in St. Louis at the age of 93, one of the Selma sisters, who was a sister for 71 years. For 71 years. But there are many dioceses in the United States where there are no African American Catholics, and many others where the numbers are very few. And so many Catholics of European background who live in rural communities virtually have no contacts with African American Catholics or with African American people at all. Indeed, they may have no contact with anything to inform them about the Black Lives Matter movement or why it is a reality in the United States, except for what they see on television and what they read in the newspaper, depending on what they watch on television, whether it is BBC or CNN or Fox or MSNBC or the traditional channels. Depending on what they watch, they are fed a steady diet of points of view, each having their own bias, each having their own prejudice. So that is the reality. 69 million Catholics in this country and only 2.9 million African American Catholics. When Dear Joseph Francis, the late auxiliary bishop of Newark, New Jersey, was asked, "Excellency, considering how much the church has done for you and your people, why are there so few African American Catholics?" And Joseph, without hesitancy, said, "Well, if you had seen and heard what I've seen and heard, if you had experienced what my parents and my grandparents had experienced, if you had experienced what I have experienced in my own life as a priest and a bishop, you would not be asking, how can there be so few? You would be asking, how can there be so many? How can there be so many?" The reality, the Catholic Church and the Black Lives Matter movement be a flaw at the foundation. A flaw at the foundation. The Catholic Church in the United States has been a part, in some ways unwittingly, of a flaw at the foundation as far as recognizing the dignity and value of people of color in this country. It can be traced to various places, including the willingness on the part of the Catholic Church to not object to, but to support the collecting and buying and selling of enslaved free human beings and the terrible tragedy of the European slave trade and the Middle Passage of bringing people from West Africa to this country. The Catholic Church was not vocal in opposing this reality. Indeed, a Catholic bishop was one of those who helped to initiate this process of bringing human beings, enslaved free human beings, to this country to work on the cotton plantations, the tobacco plantations, and the sugarcane plantation. But perhaps we can trace the flaw in a special way to a particular Catholic who unwittingly did such great harm. It's a man whose name you may not know. His name is Roger Taney, a Catholic. A Catholic who on March 6, 1857, the first Catholic to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court under Andrew Jackson, whose painting is proudly displayed in the Oval Office today, he wrote the ruling of the Supreme Court in the case of Dred Scott versus John F. A. O. Sanford, saying that Dred Scott and his wife Harriet could not sue for their freedom because they were not people, they were property. No more of no greater value than their owner's horse, their cow, their chicken, or their barn. And this ruling, this flaw at the foundation, which then contributed very much to the debate that led to the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation and the Jim Crow laws that followed and the Confederate Monument controversy about which we heard so much in recent weeks and months, can be traced to this argument that people of African descent in the United States here not freely, not coming through Ellis Island, but coming in chains, cannot sue for their dignity as human beings because they are nothing other than property, like your barn, your horse, your cow, your chicken, or your dog. Historically, the Catholic Church has not been actively engaged in conversation with African American communities at the level of ideas and major movements since the terrible reality of the Civil War. The Catholic Church has not been a part of the emergence of African-American consciousness. While several popes and not a few Catholics condemn the anti-Christian practice of enslaving free human beings and bringing them to work in the lucrative plantations which, of course, became the engine of America. If you know the great book by Edward Baptiste called The Half Has Not Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. In this book, The Half Has Not Been Told makes it clear that enslaving free human beings from West Africa was the very engine that created American capitalism and the wealth that endures to this day. Many do not know it, many do not admit it, but it is the truth. The larger Catholic community maintained a distance from the abolitionist movement in which the church played no leadership role. In 1889, Daniel Rood initiated a series of black Catholic congresses. The Fifth Congress of Baltimore in 1894 said, "We hope to hail the day when the American people, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, and the laity shall rise up in might and stamp out prejudice, which is today destroying the lifeblood of the country." However, that did not happen. That did not happen. Nor did the church involve itself or become interested in the Niagara Movement, 1905 to 1906, led by W.E.B. Du Bois, which forcefully worked for the welfare of people of color, demanding equal rights, and laid the foundations that led to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Nor did the Catholic Church address the Marcus Garvey Back to Africa Movement, 1918 to 1920, which urged all Americans of African background to establish new lives for themselves in Liberia. The church did not rise up and speak for the dignity of these human beings. And as the Harlem Renaissance unfolded, 1919 to 1940, producing many eloquent voices portraying the African-American experience, including Alain Locke, author of the classic The New Negro, Claude McKay, Jamaican-born poet and essayist who became a Catholic in Chicago and who devoted himself to the Catholic Youth Organization, Zora Neale Hurston, a visionary writer and folklorist of international renown, Langston Hughes, the poet laureate of the Harlem Renaissance, whose famous I Too Sing America adorns the walls of the Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, and County Cullen, the brilliant, haunting voice of the Harlem Renaissance, who gave us the poem Incident, a poem, if you do not know it, you should know it. And many others, many, many others raised their voices, illuminating the African American experience in the United States. But other than Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s eloquent writings, for the most part, if you look in Catholic journals and periodicals, you do not see the Catholic Church being attentive and being in dialogue with the essential African-American voices. You do not see the Catholic Church seeking to be informed by the voices that have articulated the depths and the meaning of the African-American experience. This lack of history of dialogue underscores the difficulties the church encounters if it wants to have a real conversation with the Black Lives Matter movement. We cannot undo history. And people have long memories. When people say, well, now the church wants to evangelize the African-American community. The Catholic Church wants to go to all these people of color who are very happy at the Baptist Church, very happy at the African Methodist Episcopal Church, very happy as members of the Pentecostal Church, very happy as the members of the Jehovah's Witnesses. But now we want you to know that you're all welcome. We don't need to have segregated churches or segregated schools. You're all welcome. Well, people have long memories. They're very happy where they are. Very happy where they are. And of course, sometimes the welcome is more superficial than real. Continuing with the outline, this is number C. We live in different worlds. Number C. We live in different worlds. There are no reliable statistics concerning how many African Americans are actively involved in Black Lives Matter. and certainly no statistic as to how many African-American Catholics, but it's believed that the number is quite small. That the key voices of the movement are young people in their 20s and 30s. Many of them are actually women. There is also no reliable way of determining how many African-American Catholics support positions espoused by Black Lives Matter. But this much I know. I know for a fact that some African-American Catholics are very sympathetic to some of the issues raised by this movement. I know for a fact that, from my impression, that there are many people who think that the Catholic Church, from the point of view of the Black Lives Matter movement, is a reality that they don't need to think about at all. The supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement assume that the Catholic Church does not give any thought to them. As one person said to me in Chicago, "Bishop, we live in different worlds. We live in two different worlds. Our concerns and yours cannot find a common cause." While there is a degree of awareness of the church's various social, educational, healthcare ministries that make positive contributions to African American communities, the primary impression that some supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement have of the Catholic Church is that it's a large, white, conservative, mainly Republican institution that stands aloof from the confrontational movements such as Black Lives Matter. As a matter of fact, many Catholics are actually Democrats, but that is the impression. Movement members think the church is more a part of the problem than the solution because it has a necessary allegiance to what they call white privilege. The movement sees an incompatibility between itself and the Catholic Church's out-of-touch way of living, not in keeping with the times, especially the moral teachings of the Catholic Church on marriage, rejecting what movement leaders call marriage equality, that is, marriage between two people of the same sex. The Church's teaching on contraception and abortion, what the movement leaders call women's reproductive justice, women's right to choose to end their pregnancies, and the Church's teaching on homosexual activities, what movement leaders call gay rights, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender concerns, now reduced, of course, to a few letters of the alphabet, which is an interesting development in itself. So the Catholic Church is perceived, as a reality that is completely separated from these gritty, day-to-day existential concerns of the Black Lives Matter movement. Those members with whom I've had the opportunity to speak personally, and there are very few, say that the Black Protestant churches don't play much of a role in their communities. Certainly, they wouldn't expect the Catholic Church to do so. The Black Protestant churches don't have the same role that they had in the civil rights movements in eras gone by. While there is an appreciation of the presence of ministers and some priests on the streets during urban disturbances, the Black Lives Matter movement does not embrace traditional Christian theologies and ideas about praying to keep peace and to change hearts. As one person wrote to me, "Turning the other cheek is not in our playbook." They are not interested in a passive respectability type of Christianity. They embrace a radical theology of inclusion inspired by a revolutionary Jesus, and they prefer a Jesus who spent more time confronting the powerful structures of the Roman Empire and Judaism than a Jesus who spent his time turning the other cheek. Nevertheless, I was not surprised to find that some members of Black Lives Matter had a favorable impression of the current Bishop of Rome. They said our Holy Father, Pope Francis, is a pretty good dude. They, like many Catholics, had not actually read anything that His Holiness had written. They, like many Catholics, had not actually studied the encyclical letters that have been produced by their own pontiff. They, like many Catholics, glean most of their ideas from a few sentences from the evening news or photograph in Time magazine. Their high regard for the successor of Peter are influenced by their erroneous impressions that our Holy Father is seriously considering radically changing fundamental moral and doctrinal teachings of the Catholic Church, and so the Catholic Church will finally be relevant to the 21st century. When I assured them that while the Holy Father has brought a renewed pastoral spirit of compassion and mercy to his pontificate, there is nothing to substantiate the media speculations that the Bishop of Rome is planning to initiate a radical theological revolution that will result in a Catholic Church that is no longer recognizable to the Church of St. John Paul II or the Church of Pope Benedict XVI. When they hear that, they say, well, maybe he's not so cool after all. Always keeping our eye on how much time we have, we turn now to section 4, profound differences, abortion and Black Lives Matter, crime and Black Lives Matter. We shall have to abbreviate some of this, but this is an important theme, and as guilty bystanders, we cannot ignore these themes as a source of tension between the Catholic Church and the Black Lives Matter movement, and the general secular culture, for that matter. Because the Catholic Church believes that all lives matter, from conception to natural death, the Catholic community has been deeply involved in efforts to argue forcefully in the public square in defense of the developing human life in the womb and in increasing its opposition to the death penalty. The Black Lives Matter movement generally agrees with the Catholic Church concerned about the death penalty, which is imposed disproportionately on offenders who are poor and who are people of color and who lack adequate legal representation. The movement certainly appreciates the plea of Pope Francis to world leaders to abolish the death penalty altogether. This they find impressive. However, the movement is outspoken in its defense of what it calls reproductive justice and reproductive rights, and in its embrace of the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court. Like many Americans, including, sadly, some who consider themselves Catholics, the Black Lives Matter movement rejects the argument of those who speak in defense of human life in the mother's womb. Like many defenders of abortion rights in the larger secular American society, many in the movement express a strong acceptance of the position that fetal organisms do not have legal status of human persons at any stage of gestation. As a result, the life can be ended at any time. The position that fetal life is not human, or at the very least, not becoming human, is asserted without necessarily rigorous philosophical or theological argument. Indeed, since the court permits abortion, many argue that it is just tissue in the womb. And yet, when a mother suffers a miscarriage, even those in the Black Lives Matter movement do not say, I'm so sad because I lost my fetus. They say, I lost my baby. Black Lives Matter advocates, along with most who favor abortion, place the focus not on the ethical questions of what is being done to the life in the womb, but on the legal question of a mother's right to control her own body and determine when or if she will have children. Movement spokespersons are generally opposed to any federal or state law that would place limits on a mother's right to have an abortion. Their critics say that little consideration is given to the idea that the time to exercise this right is before becoming pregnant, not after becoming pregnant. They reject the assertion that African-American women are killing their own children. People in the Black Lives Matter movement say this position leads some African-Americans to protest against black genocide. And some people argue who disagree with the Black Lives Matter movement that the most dangerous place for an African-American to be in the United States is not the streets of Chicago or Detroit or St. Louis. The most dangerous place is the mother's womb. Quoting a variety of statistics about abortion in the African American community, those in the Black Lives Matter movement say, by calling attention to these statistics, the goal is to frighten African American women so they cannot exercise the same fundamental right that white women exercise in large numbers and make their own reproductive choices. They believe in defending the rights of African American women who wish to end their pregnancy is a greater concern than the supposed right to life of the fetus. And as they put it, The right of one African-American woman to end her pregnancy places no burden on another African-American woman who believes, for whatever reason, that abortion is wrong, immoral, or sinful. They argue that if people of religious beliefs believe that ending fetal life in the womb is wrong, then obviously they should not do it. But who are they to impose their views on us, especially poor women of color who cannot afford to bring other children into the world? This is just the tip of an iceberg of one of the most difficult and complex issues between Christianity right now and the Black Lives Matter movement, wherever any dialogue might exist. But moving on to B, crime and black lives. When pressed, representatives of the Black Lives Matter movement are willing to concede, ultimately, that all lives really do matter. They acknowledge that. But they say their goal is to confront white people who say all lives matter, but who do not act as if the lives of the poor and people of color matter. Many priests and deacons and religious sisters and members of the Christian faithful who serve in our urban communities around the country raise the burning question, why does a movement that is rightly calling attention to violent, deadly conflicts between white police officers and young African-American men seem to ignore the obvious reality that most young African-American men who die violent deaths do so not at the hands of racist, rogue white police officers, but sadly at the hands of other African-American men? 93% of African-American murder victims are murdered by other African-American people. 84% of white murder victims are murdered by other white people. Black and white commentators often raise the question of self-inflicted violence, crime in black communities. They are distressed when the Black Lives Matter movement responds that it is painfully aware of many violent crimes in African-American neighborhoods. The movement knows that many people think their outrage should be focused on the many acts of violence within the community rather than the relatively few acts of violence inflicted from outside the community. But their counter argument is always that even though the number of white police officers who inflict violence on African American youth is small by comparison, their voices must be raised in protest over the violent actions of white police officers because these officers are committed to serving and protecting all citizens. They are not only violating this commitment, but they're also frequently doing so without any punishment of any kind. Concerning the Black Lives Matter movement and crime, one of the great issues, of course, is the widespread presence of weapons of mass destruction in our communities. We hear the conversation going on today in the White House with the President of the United States, with young people coming from the terrible events recently in Florida, pleading for change. And we all know when the dust settles, when the candlelight ceremonies are over, when the prayer vigils and funerals are over, when the thoughts and prayers from political leaders are ended, it is very likely nothing will happen. His Holiness Pope Francis, in speaking to Congress, having cited Thomas Merton, said this: why are deadly weapons being sold to those who plan to inflict untold suffering on individuals and society? Sadly, the answer is, as we all know, is simply for money. Money that is drenched in blood, often innocent blood. In the face of this shameful and culpable silence, it is our duty to confront the problem and to stop this armed trade that is causing so much harm, so much suffering, so much death in American cities. Listen, learn, think, pray, act. Listen, learn, think, pray, and act. Thomas Merton and the racial divide in the United States, the Catholic Church, and the Black Lives Matter movement. This is not a simple topic, and I've spoken for a long time, and I've skipped over many pages. All I think I have been able to do for you tonight is perhaps share with you information that you did not have, or a point of view that you did not have, or give you some fodder so that you can put it into the mill of your heart and your parish and your community, your fellow students, faculty, so that you can listen, learn, think, pray, and act. I think St. Teresa of Calcutta is completely right when she says, everybody can do something. You cannot change social structures in India. You cannot change the laws in the states of Kentucky or Florida about weapons of mass destruction. You cannot change the laws concerning gun ownership except by participating in voting to try to vote for people who support reasonable, sane laws. You cannot resolve the mental health issues of some young people who are so disturbed that they may be out to commit mass murder. But you can do something to bridge the racial divide. You can do something. You can say to your fellow students or your family members or friend who you hear belittling people because of their race or religion or nationality or their social or sexual situation, you can say, I am a follower of Jesus Christ and his law of love, love God and love neighbor. I cannot be a part of this. You can say in a kind way to a grandfather, a grandmother, an uncle, an aunt, a sister, a brother, a son, or a daughter, this is not consistent with the teaching of Jesus Christ. Not to offend someone, not to hurt their feelings, not to get into an argument, but you can do something. You can do something. You can propose that somebody read something that otherwise they would not read. You can contribute time, talent, and treasure to some activity right here locally, right here in Louisville, not something on the national or international stage, right here locally, that can bridge the racial divide. You can learn more about the Black Lives Matter movement with its strengths and its considerable weaknesses. Everybody can do something. Everybody can do something. And having been invited to speak here in so many places about the racial divide in the United States, I am very aware of how easy it is for people to say, well, wasn't that nice? The bishop came, he gave a nice talk, we had our picture taken with him, it was very nice. You go out and have some coffee and rolls and say, that was swell. But then nobody does anything. Nobody does anything. I can't tell you what you can do in your family, in your neighborhood, in your school, in your parish. But the Catholic Church is an active participant in maintaining the racial divide in the United States, wittingly or unwittingly. That we cannot deny. A long, painful history. And if you do nothing at all, then I share with you the words of James Baldwin, whose writings were so appealing to Thomas Merton. When Baldwin quoted the old song, God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more warnings, the fire next time. To conclude, perhaps no one has provided a better account of the radical anthropology, psychology, theology, and spirituality at the root of the truth that Black lives matter because all lives matter, and all lives matter because Black lives matter. No one has provided a more radical anthropology, psychology, theology, and spirituality than Thomas Merton himself. Thomas Merton's famous rendering of his epiphanic experience in 1958 in downtown Louisville, described in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, are words for our meditation now and always. He wrote, in Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. This sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud. I have the immense joy of being man, a member of the race in which God himself became incarnate. As if the sorrow and stupidness of the human condition could overwhelm me. Now I realize what we all are. And if only everybody could realize this. But it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. We are all guilty bystanders, but this conjecture is one we must never forget, something that cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around and they are all shining like the sun. Thank you. Thank you very much.